joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In the summer of 1974, the nation was focused on Nixon, Watergate, Vietnam, until one morning in August, when New Yorkers looked up in the sky and saw a man walking across a wire 110 stories up between the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. Author Colm McCann joins me in the studio to talk about why he used that real-life tightrope walk in his latest work of fiction. The title is Let the Great World Spin. You're going to hear Colm read from the book in just a few moments, but I do invite you to join us with your own questions and comments. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Colm, it's good to see you again.
It's lovely to be back here. Thank you so much.
You know, 9/11 is only mentioned in a single sentence toward the end of the book. But in fact, was it the impetus for the book?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember the morning of 9/11, my father-in-law was in the first building to be hit, the second building to come down. And he thankfully was able to get out of and walk up through the city to our apartment where we lived at the time with my kids on 71st Street. And my daughter ran down into his arms. And she was so happy to have him back. But then she hid for a little while in a cupboard. And she'd never hid there before. And I went to find her. I said, "What's wrong, love?" And she said, "Well, Poppy's burning." And I said, no, Poppy's not burning because, you know, there was a fire downtown. We didn't tell her what had gone on. And she said, no, Poppy's burning from the inside out. And it was one of those moments sort of out of the mouth of babes. And you think, I'm going to remember this my whole life. And then the question became for the next few years is how does a writer get at 9/11 without, you know, getting directly at it so that people can experience it, perhaps even as a moment of creation rather than a moment of destruction. And then I remembered that beautiful image of a man, you know, walking a quarter of a mile in the sky. Isn't it? It's glorious, isn't it?
Glorious. Did you see him yourself?
No. You know, I was 9 years old living in Ireland. I was probably on my holidays in the west of Ireland fishing in a pier in the west of Ireland and had no idea.
But you've seen films.
I've seen films since and I've seen photographs and I've sort of stepped into it by imagining it. But, you know, I have terrible vertigo, so I couldn't.
So do
even,
I. Do you? So do I. I know exactly what you mean from those heights.
But can you imagine a quarter of a mile? This guy, he went back and forth eight times. He lay down on the wire, you know, and it was just extraordinary. At the very end, he sort of ran. Because when you're on a tightrope, you duck walk if you're going quickly. He ran across the wire and stepped into the arms of the cops who were waiting on the other side.
And what you tell are the stories of some of the people who were down there watching.
That's right. What interested me was the sort of anonymous lives that take place on the day that this act of beauty and creation. So what's it like? Yeah, sure, to walk on a tightrope quarter of a mile in the sky, but also what was more interesting to me, what's it like to walk on a tightrope that's, you know, 1 inch from the ground? Because we can fall then too.
Would you read for us from the beginning of the book?
Sure, I'd be delighted to. Those who saw him hushed on Church Street, Liberty, Cortland, West Street, Fulton, Vesey. It was a silence that heard itself, awful and beautiful. Some thought at first it might have been a trick of the light, something to do with the weather, an accident of shadow fall. Others figured it might be the perfect city joke, stand around and point upwards until people gathered, tilted their heads, nodded, affirmed, until all were staring upwards at nothing at all, like waiting for the end of a Lenny Bruce gag. But the longer they watched, the surer they were. He stood at the very edge of the building, shaped dark against the grey of the morning. A window washer, maybe, or a construction worker, or a jumper. up there at the height of 110 stories, utterly still, a dark toy against a cloudy sky. He could only be seen at certain angles, so that the watchers had to pause at street corners, find a gap between buildings, or meander from the shadows to get a view unobstructed by cornicework, gargoyles, balustrades, roof edges. None of them had yet made sense of the line strung at his feet from one tower to the other. Rather, it was the man shape that held him there, their necks craned, torn between the promise of doom and the disappointment of the ordinary. It was the dilemma of the watcher. They didn't want to wait around for nothing at all, some idiot standing on the precipice of the towers, but they didn't want to miss the moment either if he slipped or got arrested or dove, arms stretched. Around the watchers, the city still made its everyday noises. Car horns, garbage trucks, ferry whistles, the thrum of the subway. The M22 bus pulled in against the sidewalk, braked, sighed down into a pothole. A flying chocolate wrapper touched against the fire hydrant. Taxi doors slammed, bits of thrash sparred in the darkest reaches of the alleyways. Sneakers found their sweet spots. The leather of briefcases rubbed against trouser legs. A few umbrella tips clinked against the pavement. Revolving doors pushed quarters of conversation out into the streets. But the watchers could have taken all those sounds and smashed them down into a single noise, and still they wouldn't have heard all that much at all. Even when they cursed, it was done quietly, reverently. They found themselves in small groups together beside the traffic lights on the corner of Church and Day, gathered under the awning of Sam's barber shop, in the doorway of Charlie's Audio, a tight little theatre of men and women against the railings of St. Paul's Chapel, elbowing for space at the windows of the Woolworth building, lawyers, elevator operators, doctors, cleaners, prep chefs, diamond merchants, fish sellers, sad jeaned whores. All of them reassured by the presence of one another, stenographers, traders, delivery boys, sandwich board men, card sharks, Con Ed, Ma Bell, Wall Street, a locksmith in his van on the corner of Day and Broadway, a bike messenger lounging against a lamppost on West, a red-faced rummy out looking for an early morning pour. From the Staten Island Ferry they glimpsed him, from the meatpacking warehouses on the west side, from the new high-rises in Battery Park, from the breakfast carts down on Broadway, from the plaza below, and from the towers themselves. Sure, there were some who ignored the fuss, who didn't want to be bothered. It was 7:47 in the morning, and they were too jacked up for anything but a desk, a pen, a telephone. Up they came from the subway stations, from limousines, off city buses, crossing the street at a clip, refusing the prospect of a gawk. Another day, another dollar. But as they passed the little clumps of commotion, they began to slow down. Some stopped altogether, shrugged, turned nonchalantly, walked to the corner, bumped up against the watchers, went to the tips of their toes, gazed over the crowd, and then introduced themselves with a wow, or a gee whiz, or a Jesus H. Christ. The man above remained rigid, and yet his mystery was mobile. He stood beyond the railing of the observation deck of the South Tower. At any moment, he might just take off.
Colin McCann, his new novel is titled Let the Great World Spin. That image, watched from the ground, must have seemed as though someone had gone crazy.
Sure.
Someone was about to commit suicide.
Right.
Someone couldn't be up there just to prove a point.
It's like an angel in the sky. And it's an attempt at beauty. One of those strange things. You know, one of the things about life, as you know very well, and I think most people listen, is that the great thing about it is that we are still, in face of all the evidence, we are still capable of small beauties, whether that be by the World Trade Center, whether that be in Iraq, with the soldiers we're talking about this morning, whether that be in the suburbs of, you know, Illinois or New York. There are always moments where we can achieve a little moment of beauty. And that's what sort of keeps us going. So it sort of goes against the dark.
your father-in-law, you said, having escaped from that building and having been somehow discovered by your daughter to be burning inside. How did he go on with his life?
Well, like a lot of people, he went about it silently, quietly, didn't make a triumph of it, got really upset about what was happening in the world when sort of the idea of justice got turned into the idea of revenge. Still at night, he wakes up and he sees the faces of those young men and young women climbing up the stairs as he was climbing down the stairs. And he still sees them. And I think a lot of people still see them. And our job, it seems, as human beings, as novelists, as whatever we happen to be, is to make a sort of empathetic leap into the body of the other, whether it be that man coming down the stairs or whether it be the woman who's selling apples in a market in Baghdad. And it seems to me that if we can get to the core of that, we can actually recover. Because I'm interested in the idea of grace and resolution and healing. And that's what the novel tries to do.
Colin McCann, and the book is titled Let the Great World Spin. We'll talk about some of his characters and why that high wire walk brought them into such focus for him. Stay with us. And if you've just joined us, novelist Colin McCann is with me. His new book, Let the Great World Spin, begins with Philippe Petit up there, 110 stories, walking between the two World Trade Towers. Here's an email from Phil in Reston, Virginia, who says, I was on the street below. Mm-hmm. I exited the 4 train at Day Street, just west of Broadway, at about 8:30 a.m. after Mr. Petit's feat. People all around me were looking up. I asked them what some of them were looking at. They didn't know. Mm-hmm. We're looking up to try to see what others were looking at. I love that crowds continued looking up longer after the police had taken Mr. Petit away.
How beautiful. How beautiful. The thing is, the people are still looking up. I mean, you can go down there now and there are no towers, but you can still look up. And this is the triumph of the imagination. That's why Phil is still there. That's why he would be a character in this novel if I could have known.
And in fact, Philippe Petit fades totally from your novel, instead replaced by this enormous cast of characters. I love Corrigan, the Irish monk.
I had a good time. Corrigan actually introduced me to all the other characters. He is an Irish monk living in the streets of the Bronx, and basically his life is an act of grace, and he tries to let his influence enter the air. He tries to just to be a good person, and he deals with the prostitutes there, and he helps them out, and he allows them to use his apartment just to go to the bathroom and to relax. And so this character Corrigan, he introduced me to all these other people who were in the city at the time.
So he came first.
He came first. I was interested in the idea. I'm sure you know Daniel Berrigan, the great Jesuit priest who's in New York, and I loved the idea of what Daniel Berrigan did with his life and the goodness that he brought about, even in the face of authority and so on. But I wanted to create a fictional character. So Corrigan spun out of Dan Berrigan. And then I tried to imagine, well, what would it be like in 74 to be a liberation theologian, but on the streets, you know, living in, I mean, there were fires in the Bronx in 74. The place was burning. The murder rate was huge.
And his brother comes from Ireland because
right.
he's concerned about him.
Right.
And he finds he's been terribly beaten up by the pimps.
That's right. But life goes on. And Corrigan looks around the world that he's in and he says, you know what? Someday the meek might actually want it. And he wants to get the world to that place where the meek, who you should inherit the earth, they should actually need it and want it. And so he's looking for goodness, looking for salvation, looking for... And yet he has a terrible crisis of faith because at the time he's also fallen in love with this young Spanish woman who works in a nursing home. And his, you know, he is the fulcrum of the novel, and yet he also falls, and he falls quite spectacularly in the same way that the Philippe Petit character does not fall. In other words, you know, these anonymous corners of human experience, these stories that are going on in the city every single day, this Walt Whitman poem that is New York, there's so much more than just that great act of art that's high in the sky. The great act of art is sort of living your life down below.
Tell me about the women in this book. You talk about Jaslyn.
Right.
And you talk about her mother.
Oh, well, this is her mother, Tilly, is a 38-year-old grandmother who is still, as I say, quote unquote, on the stroll. So she's a prostitute in the Bronx. And I worked for months and months and months to try and access her voice. I went out with the cops in New York. The homicide detectives in the Bronx took me around. The homicide detectives in New York had me sit in the back seat. I went over files full of rap sheets and everything. And I was trying to find a woman who had been on the streets in the early 70s, but they're nearly all gone. They're either lost to heroin or they've reformed their lives in some way and they don't want to talk about what it was like.
Tilly is, what, 38 or so.
Yeah.
Her daughter, Jaslyn, is a heroin addict.
That's right.
In addition to being a prostitute. And Jaslyn has two little girls.
Two little babies that actually become the later fulcrum of the novel. So while we lose Philippe Petit, we find these two little babies emerging from a project only to be rescued at the end. Because I believe in redemption, I believe in salvation, even with all the grime and the everyday torment of like what it was like in New York back in 74 or what it's like now, there is always, it seems to me, or it's my job to find some sort of light. Brodsky talks about, you know, the darkness restoring the light in certain ways. And this, to me, is what I want to get at. And I would like the reader... Well, the reader interprets the book for me. I don't want to tell them anything. So hopefully, though, at the end, they come out like on some sort of high, having gone through the mire.
One of the women in this book, Claire, is very much a high society.
That's right.
Woman who has lost a son
right.
in Vietnam. And she gathers women around her who've also lost relatives in Vietnam, and she hopes to be able to talk about herself, her own grief. And she's frustrated because everybody wants to talk about Philippe.
That's right. But, you know, the thing about it is grief is democratic. And I wanted to talk about Vietnam and yet do it through the eyes of a wealthy woman who lives on Park Avenue. And then I found out that there were computer operators went to Vietnam. And I thought, OK, I'll make her the mother of a computer operator who went over to Vietnam. Because, you know, we talk about war and we talk about, you know, all these things. And all she wanted to say to her son the day he left is, the only thing you need to know about war, son, is don't go. And if we could all say that, I mean, of course, it's difficult to say, and this is the ultimate sacrifice that we must do. But for me, it was fun to get at a wealthy woman who has, you know, won murals on the wall and, you know, fancy art, and she lives in a penthouse on Park Avenue, and yet she too shares that sort of American grief at the time, and she is not a stereotype, I hope, whatsoever, but she can't talk. She's frustrated, and all she wants to say is, you know, our boys, they were in it together. And she gets around all these working class women who come to her house, and she's nervous that they come to her house. And yet she, at the end, becomes the catalyst, the rescuer of, I can't give too much away, but the rescuer of what it means to be alive at that particular time.
It's interesting that you've confessed that she's your favorite character.
Yeah, her and her and the 38-year-old prostitute. I mean, how do you put them together? You hold these contradictory ideas. I mean, that's the essence of good stuff, really, isn't it? When you can hold contradictory ideas in the palm of your hands and say, I love both of these things, and nothing is absolute. There is no absolute black and there is no absolute white. We must come together. Like, it's kind of like how this country is coming together. It feels to me now that this country is coming together in a sort of spectacular contradiction. And once we acknowledge contradiction, we become better people.
How do you define that contradiction you see here now?
Well, I mean, once we have somebody like Barack Obama coming in and enabling us to look at one another in all our different shades. My son, the day that Barack was elected, we're walking down to school with him. He says, Dad, do we have any African-American in us? No, it's all Irish. He says, ah, damn it, I really wanted to have some African-American in me. Now, that would never have happened 30 years ago. And I just wanted to pick him up in my arms and hug him because I felt this is a new era. This is a new way to look at the world. And I felt very proud.
At the same time, here on Capitol Hill, those differences continue to be very, very defined.
Sure. Well, I mean, we can't be romantic or sentimental about it. It's always going to be a fight. But the fact of the matter is there is a possibility there. And despite what goes on and all the rivalry and schisms and canyons that people make in thought and feeling, there is a way that we can sort of come together and appreciate one's differences.
In a recent column in the New York Times, you said stories are the best democracy we have. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, anyone can tell a story. Everybody out there listening right now has a story that they want to tell. They also have the ability to listen to stories. So it goes across gender. It goes across wealth. It goes across race. It goes across time, geography, boundaries, countries, everything. And it's the most beautiful thing. We're all storytellers.
We're all storytellers. Many want to tell a story, but for some, it's far more difficult than others. For you, the gift began when?
I just find myself sort of extraordinarily lucky, you know, to be a writer and to sort of have imaginative access to other people's stories. So, I mean, I remember writing about my grandfather when I was 9 years old. I remember being 20 years old and going to the projects of in Dublin and talking to women who'd been battered by their husbands. And I started to realise, like, I don't really exist in the world, but I'm here to operate and to look around and to maybe listen to other people's stories and to try and translate them on the page. I feel, honestly, I feel so privileged to be able to do this sort of job, because I know certain people can't write down their stories, but everybody wants to tell them. And so if you can walk into a novel, you can maybe find your story.
Colm can. His book is titled Let the Great World Spin. Talk about both the title and the cover of your book, which I find fascinating. Tell us about that.
We had a long time searching for a cover. We were looking, like, how do we represent the city? And then we found a spectacular Italian artist by the name of Matteo Pericoli, who drew a picture of the city tied together and bound up by a tightrope. And he just did a beautiful job. And then the title itself comes from a Tennyson poem, which is, Let the Great World Spin Forever Down the Ringing Grooves of Change. And it seemed to me, that's what I want. So how do we continue? How do we go on? Because there is this change. And that was tied in with a 6th century Arabic poem, the suspended poems, the Mulaqat. Because Tennyson got his inspiration from these Arabic poems. And I thought, oh, wonderful, okay. So we can make the leapfrog all the way backwards. And we can also go forwards at the same time. Because the fact of the matter is, you know, we're here. We're in the now, but our children will go on and they will tell these stories again and again.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's open the phones now, 800-433-8850. The book is titled Let the Great World Spin by Colm McCann. To Fairport, New York. Good morning, Doug. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Mr. McCann. You are fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm gonna go find your book. my question, though, is a brief comment and then a question, because it's related to something you said about Philippe. You mentioned that after, I think it was 8 crossings and lying down and so on, he walked into the open arms of the police. So I'm assuming, and you can correct me if I'm wrong in your answer, that he may have been arrested or detained. But yes. How does one set something like this up and put a cable between the trade towers?
Uh-huh.
I was there and ate on Windows of the World, and I've experienced the height and the complexity of the buildings and the sway. How do you set something like that up without anyone knowing? My final comment before you answer is, it's a shame because in 1974, that's the year I was married, and I remember this as one of the second or third most memorable things of that year beside my wedding.
If you have a chance, Doug, I know Colm wants to make a point. If you have a chance, you should see the film Man on Wire, and you will begin to have an understanding of how he did this. Colm.
I love this question and I love this idea because it goes back to an ancient American idea of the bow and arrow. So what he did was he stood on one side and he had an accomplice on the far side, and he fired with a bow and arrow a fishing line across to the other side. And then he hauled in the fishing line. And on that fishing line was a chain. And then on that chain was the actual tightrope itself, which weighed 250 pounds.
A huge cable, was it not?
A huge cable, yeah, like 1 3/4 inches
right.
thick. And he pulled it taut with winches. And he did this all undercover. Nobody knew that he was there. It was
what, like, time of the day was he doing this?
Late at night under the cover of darkness. And then he did his walk very early in the morning. And the thing is, he called it one of the great art crimes of the century. And I think it is. Don't you think that it's
absolutely
an art crime?
Don't you also assume he had accomplices within the building?
Well, they had no accomplices within the building itself. They managed to forge IDs. They did all these things, but his accomplices went up onto the other side. Unfortunately, there was no film done of the actual walk. But if you watch the tremendous documentary Man on Wire, it makes you feel like you've been walking from one side to the other.
And the way those that cable had to be anchored, the manner in which he over and over and over again off-site planned for that walk.
Oh, it's a beautiful mathematics. It's a beautiful science. But then it becomes that he has to lose his body. He has to walk in the middle of no, it's like embracing nothingness. You lose everything. And I have a line in the novel. I hope it's not too rude, but he says he feels like he's having sex with the wind.
Quite a line. We'll take just a short break here. 800-433-8850. Do join us. Your questions, comments for Colm McCann. His book is titled Let the Great World Spin.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, our holiday week series concludes with Ted Danson talking about lots of things, including being friends with Larry David.
It's a very scary kind of proposition, hanging out with Larry David.
And we'll have a tribute to Johnny Mercer on the New Year's Day edition of Fresh Air.
If you've just joined us, novelist Colm McCann is with me. He's the author of another novel called Zoli and Dancer, but his newest, all about and yet hardly mentioning that great walk between the World Trade Towers, is titled Let the Great World Spin. Now, Colm, you and I have already talked about your earliest character, Corrigan.
Right.
The fellow who becomes a monk. You kill him off. In the first chapter, he is impaled on his own steering wheel.
Right.
And Jasmine, this young woman, the mother of two young children, who is herself a prostitute, she dies immediately.
Right.
Why?
You know, I didn't realize for a long time, you know, writers, I mean, people think that writers know what they're doing. I'll be honest with you, most of the time I have no clue what I'm doing. I'm just sort of, I'm flying by the seat of my pants and wondering, like, why is this character doing this? And I love the character of Corrigan. I thought, okay, I've got to carry him all the way through. But he died in the first chapter, and he died alongside this young prostitute as they're driving home from the courthouse on this ordinary day when Philippe Petit does a tightrope walk across the World Trade Center. And I thought, oh, I got to bring him back because I like him too much. He would never come back for me. And it was towards the end of the novel that I realized that the two main towers of the novel, if you will, the human towers of the novel, collapse in the first chapter. And what you do is you spend the rest of the novel trying to build them back up again. And so it becomes an act of creation that becomes reflective of 9/11 rather than an act of destruction. So we don't have to think about the grief or the whole way along.
Did you know that before you wrote the book, or did you?
No idea.
No idea.
No idea.
You realized it after you had written it.
You know, the great Don DeLillo came to a class that I taught at Hunter College, and he said the most extraordinary thing to my students. He said, in the most humble way, because he's a wonderful, humble man, he said, I seem to be the benefactor of an occasional revelation. In other words, it's this gift that the writer gets, and you don't actually know exactly what you're doing. Other people, like your readers, come along and make sense of it for you later, whether you've done something good or bad or indifferent, or they make the big leap that your own sort of heart has done, or your psychology or your mind has done. And so it was only towards the end of the novel when I discovered that it was about those little girls, those tiny two little girls emerging from a project, that I realised, oh, this is about grace. And that's why I lost my two towers at the start, because we have to rebuild.
Let's go to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Good morning, David. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
On the morning of 9/11, my son was born. He was We went to the hospital, and we were going to have labor induced. And as I sat there waiting for the doctor, who was Arabic, we turned on TV and nothing had happened yet. And then I saw the first news break from CNN of what was going on in New York City. And although we were there for what was the best day of our lives, our Arabic doctor was there for the most tragic day of his, because he said he came to this country to get away from that kind of thing. And he was absolutely destroyed, you know, inside, because the things that he had come to this country to get away from was now, you know, here in the biggest theater it could possibly be in our country, in the middle of New York City, the tallest buildings, the world's largest representation for trade and commerce and coming together in peace. And he is watching this crumble while we were having, you know, our child. When you mentioned in your book, you're talking about this, the complexity of life in the city surrounding the tower, that complexity, from what I can, is just a whirlwind around the entire country. You know, those towers reflect since 1974. Could you comment on how those come similar in your book?
Oh, could I comment on just how beautiful that story is?
Isn't that wonderful?
Could I comment on the fact that I got goosebumps and I don't have much hair left on my head, but the hair, any hair I have left, rose. That's an extraordinary story. And this is what makes the world spin, because we do have stories like that. And in so many ways, your son will grow up and charge the world with that sort of capability, the human capability to still astound us, to still make us smile in the face of all the adversity. Mm. And hopefully that Arabic doctor will remember that moment of creation too.
To Bob in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you so much for your amazing reading of the chapter, the partial reading of your book. The word portraits were reminiscent of Gertrude Stein's Cubist word portraits, and it's wonderful to know that you've done a good service to your forefather Irish writers.
Thank you.
What I remember of the World Trade Center is And I knew two people who perished there, but I don't think about them when I think about the World Trade Center. I think about the signature of George Willig on the observation deck, on the edge of the observation tower, on the edge of the building, who I believe scaled the towers rather than crossed them.
That's right.
And I also had the pleasure of visiting a public, a donated space. It was a space that the Port Authority reserved on the 87th or 88th floor for emerging artists that could go there and work and live for free.
Oh, yes.
And create their art. And it was probably half the floor. And there was just astounding emerging artists there, really beautiful stuff. And that perished. And nobody, there's no knowledge, you know, there's no acknowledgement of the kind of little things. I mean, there's the great art that was in the lobbies, but there are these little pieces of art that nobody knew about that are gone forever. Life is a very measured thing, but art should last forever. And when it gets destroyed like that, I thank you for keeping the art of the World Trade Center alive in your way.
Well, that's another beautiful thing to say, because, I mean, I don't know about you, Diane, but our memory acknowledges it. And just the fact that it was done. This is what we have to do. You know, I'm struck by the fact that for goodness to happen, it has to happen over and over and over again. For evil to occur, it must only happen once. There's an extraordinary difference there. But for and this gentleman talking about art in the World Trade Center, the fact that it happened is almost enough. The fact that we can remember it and talk about it is, but we must continue to do it over and over and over again, because we fight against evil with memory and with beauty and with acknowledgement that we're here for some sort of reason.
Bob, thanks so much for your call to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Will.
Hi, good morning, Diane Reem.
Hi.
I have a quick comment. I had the pleasure, when I was younger, of being involved with your author for several months. He was a volunteer at a place called Miracle Farms down in South Texas, and I was in a program with him over the course of 2 or 3 months, and I haven't seen him or talked to him in 20 years or so, but I just wanted to comment and say to Colin what an inspiration that he was to me as a young man in introducing writing and reading to us. He read to us a lot in the evenings and was quite an intellectual inspiration to me over my young boyhood.
Will, Colin
oh,
would
it's
like...
Will.
It's Will.
Will, hello, how are you?
I'm fine, Colin, and I listen to NPR all the time. I love it, and it's been great for me, and I was just so amazed to hear you on the radio.
It's extraordinary. Just for the listeners, to I took a bicycle across the United States many, many years ago, and I ended up in Texas outside Brenham working at this home for young boys and girls who had difficulties in their life, and I ran a wilderness program whereby we would take kids out into the wilderness and we'd build from scratch an outdoor latrine. And I would read to them at night. And Will, I can't believe that I'm actually hearing your voice, because everybody has done so well. Travis, Joe, all those kids, they come back to me at a certain point in my life.
Oh, how wonderful. How wonderful.
And it's so amazing the sense of fulfillment that Colin was able to give us young boys and really just be a mentor to us in the areas where a lot of our fathers had let us down. Hmm. And one of the ways he did minister to us was through reading. So it's very, very inspirational to hear you on the radio and be a part of this now. So.
It's lovely to hear your voice.
Will, thank you so much for calling. I think you've made Colum's day. Let's go now to Oswego, New York. Mary, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. McGann.
Good morning.
My son has done two tours in Iraq, and he tried to commit suicide Saturday. Mm. And something inside of me told me that I had to get a hold of him, and I couldn't. And I called 911 and went through all the system here and got through to Hawaii, because that's where he was. And they got to him. He was taking his last gasp of air. And it's, I think sometimes things happen for a reason. Mm. I was listening to this morning, and it was like this book was written for Joe. And he had a horrible time over there, but whenever I sent him something, he would give it to the kids. And even though I know horrible things have happened over there, those boys have done such wonderful things, too.
Oh, yes.
That's right.
Mary.
And I can't wait to buy this book for him.
Mary, tell me how your son is.
Right now, he's still in critical condition, but they think that he's going to be okay.
Oh, I hope so. I'm so glad you called him, and I'm so glad you called us this morning. I hope that you will get some person to whom you can talk about your own feelings and your own experience.
I just wanted to tell you, Mr. McCann, this sounds like a wonderful book. And
thank you.
You sound like a wonderful storyteller and teller of life.
Well, it's all about grace and recovery, and I can only wish him all the grace and all the recovery.
Mary, take good care of yourself. Thank you for calling. At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And now to Manassas, Virginia. Good morning, Lucy. Lucy, are you there?
Oh, yes, I am. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Go right ahead.
Oh, I was just going to tell Mr. McCann that I was totally enthralled, and I agree 100% with what he said. There's so much pain in the world, and, you know, it just takes repeated sparks of beauty for people to remember and to realize, you know, why we're here. And I really feel that I'm here as a writer as well to observe and to record and to help remind our children and my children that there's still beauty in the world despite all the evil that's out there. Mm-hmm. And I cannot wait to get my hands on this book.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I think we have to throw out a little glow. I mean, let's not beat around the bush in the sense that it is tough, you know, and it's a world that we wouldn't necessarily want if we could just paint it. But we have to throw off a little glow with our art or with our stories. What a country we live in. All these voices that we hear this morning, isn't it amazing?
All these voices. But I really would like to go back to what you were talking about earlier, and that is the place where our country is and how you have tried to depict that falling and rising in this novel.
Well, towards the end of the novel, without giving too much away, a young character who was left with absolutely nothing. She's left motherless. She's left homeless. Is being transported away to a children's home, and she gets rescued by one of the other characters in the novel. And for me, I tell you, when I was writing it, I was praying that Obama would be elected, because it was my Obama image. I mean, I don't want to get, you know, I don't want to say that, you know, to sanctify say the what has happened to this country, and but for me it was an enormous ray of hope when he got elected. And in many ways it struck me that I wanted to talk about the country where I live and the country where my kids are as going in a new direction, and in sort of collecting some little bits of light at the corner of the street, whether it just be street light in the Bronx under the Deegan, and making something out of that. And so it fills me with hope that we can do good things, and again that we don't turn all our sense of justice to revenge, that we look around and sort of embrace in a different way. And so the book became about this little kid, and though she hardly figures that much in the novel, she makes sense of Philippe Petit getting to the other side.
It's also about those towers rising.
Right, because they rise again. And I was even down there last week, I don't much like the machine that creates, you know, all the, you know, where you go down by the World Trade Center and people are selling photographs and like all the sorts. It bugs me somehow. But I thought one of the most beautiful things was when we had those blue laser lights that went up in the sky and they met distantly up in the sky. That seemed like a great tribute to so many people.
There's still some argument about how those towers will go up, or if.
Or if they'll go up at all.
They'll go up.
What would you put there?
I have no idea. Yeah. I think if it were up to me, I'd probably leave it in our hearts.
Right. Because then it's that imaginative space. Then.
Exactly.
Because then you can go back to what that gentleman was talking about, that art that's on the 88th floor, or the man who's a quarter mile in the sky.
Colin McCann. The book is titled Let the Great World Spin. Beautifully written.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Oh, it's really great to be here.
And thanks to all of you for taking part in this morning's program. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.